Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Another program, Take It From Us. Welcome in. I'd love to hear from you, as we always do. You know what to do. Jump on our Facebook page, Take It From Us. Leave us a comment. Hit us. Point us in the direction of a story that you think needs to be covered, anything that is really important that is on your mind. We know that Mental Health Awareness Week is important. It finished on Sunday. And there's no doubt mental well-being is a hot-button topic for so many people, and for good reason. You know, never before have so many of us been struggling with low mood and depressive disorders. So I look at Mental Health Awareness Week as an opportunity. It's an opportunity to talk about how we're going. You know, where should we be going? Where should we be heading collectively? And how do we get there? Personally, I had quite a busy week last week. I spoke at a number of events or to a number of companies around their mental well-being. I think a few companies and businesses around New Zealand really, I think, made a huge effort last week to shine a light on mental well-being and to not just, you know, raise a flag and say, hey, yeah, we're aware of it, and then not actually follow through and do anything. So I was greatly encouraged by what I was kind of able to participate in, and just to see that people are really conscious of the fact that we can't keep going like this, that we just can't. Like, there will have to be some changes being made collectively right across our society. Easier said than done, as we know. But I think companies and employers, responsible employers, they know they need to be doing something to look after our mental well-being, and they just don't know where to start. It's probably a little confronting for a lot of them. So I went and spoke to two different organisations last week who are in the throes of starting up a wellness program. And, you know, we've talked about the need for personal engagement in health. You know, it's not our fault if we're struggling, but it's also our responsibility, because we're the only ones in our lives that can truly make the changes that we want to make, with help, with assistance, by reaching out, absolutely. But ultimately, if we're not engaged in ourselves, and if we don't prioritise our health, whether that be physical, mental, emotional, then nothing is going to change. And we know that if we get one thing going in the right direction, everything else will follow. Physical health, mental health, emotional well-being, they're all linked. And if we can get one going in the right direction, in my experience, the others start to follow. So I had a really busy week, and I came away thinking about how we're going and what we're doing. And I think slowly but surely, it feels like we have reason to feel encouraged. You know, we're starting to see genuine wellness programs rolled out across New Zealand businesses. I have a mate of mine who is very high up in, I won't name the company out of courtesy to him, but he works for a company that is very well known across New Zealand, extremely well known. And he said to me, man, he said, we desperately need a wellness program in our environment. We desperately need it. It's been overlooked and mismanaged for so long, for way too long. We need to be doing something, because our staff are crying out for it. They're basically begging management to help, to offer assistance. You know, there's a lot of talk about resilience these days, where resilience is kind of like a baseline where we can bounce back to where we were before the stress in our life. What we're really after is something called anti-fragility. you know, how do we get stronger? How do we get mentally and emotionally just a little bit stronger so that we're more confident to be able to cope with just a ridiculous amount of stress in our lives at the moment? But I think we're starting to see it. So I was encouraged by that. And so that took up a large part of my week, was just being out and about and making a few notes and just seeing what people are doing. And like I say, I think there's cause for some optimism. We know that the wheels always turn slower than would be ideal. And then on Thursday, I just wanted to talk about a funeral that I went to on Thursday. It was for Willie Losse, very well known in our Pacifica community. He was a former Tongan rugby player. He worked with me for a number of years in sports broadcasting, and just a great guy. And so his funeral on Thursday, sadly, he died 3 or 4 weeks ago in South Africa. He was only 55 years of age. So he was too young for us to lose him at this time. But we went along to the funeral at Eden Park. It was an enormous turnout. It was a really big occasion. And Frank Bunce, the former All Black midfielder who was very close with Willie, gave a speech. And he actually quipped at one point, is it okay to have fun at a funeral? Like, I'm enjoying the stories. And I know what Frank was saying, because I found myself thinking the same thing. Man, this is a somber and a sad occasion, but it was also uplifting to hear so many stories about a guy that made so many people smile and he made so many people laugh. And at the end of the funeral, and there were some great speakers too, by the way, Sir Michael Jones spoke, Sir Graham Henry, you know, luminaries of New Zealand sport, Dwayne Mann, the former Kiwis player, Willie's sister spoke with such grace and humility and sensitivity. She started things off. And I made a comment to a friend of mine who also knew Willie very well. How nice was it to hear that the Willie that we knew is the Willie that everybody knew? You know, I only knew him in a professional working capacity as a broadcaster. And then, of course, you'd go out and you'd socialise and you'd hang out together. But I never knew Willie as a rugby player. I never knew Willie as a boy. I never knew him as a teenager, you know, a young man finding his feet. And we were hearing all of these great stories about his life. And it made me think about authenticity and what an authentic life Willie led, you know, and the importance of authenticity. He was just himself. He wore ridiculously bright clothes. He wore a lot of lycra. He made people laugh. A lot of the times you might have been laughing at him, not with him. But he didn't care. He laughed at himself. He had a terrific sense of humour. And he was just Willie. And people were drawn to him. And I often made notes to myself when I was in his company. Man, look at everyone that comes up and just wants to hang out with him and talk with him. I wonder why that is. Has he got some sort of magical power? And it didn't strike me until yesterday what that magical power was. He was authentic. He was just himself. And he didn't really care what anyone thought of him. And it got me thinking, you know, when we can be ourselves without burning up precious energy worrying about what others think about us, it's not to be underestimated. You know, we live in a world now where we're constantly judging ourselves and we're constantly judging each other. We're constantly comparing ourselves. We know this is not good for chronic stress. We know this is terrible for our emotional and mental well-being. It takes an enormous toll. We constantly tell ourselves that we're not good enough. We've all got the voices in our head that are constantly into us about being better. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? Well, Willie would have had those traits too, because we've all got them. But he was authentic, and it just made me smile and a little chuckle when two or three of us were talking, and I just felt the need to bring that point up, that, you know, the Willie that I knew, oh, man, he didn't have to wear 8 different faces. He didn't have 15 different sides to his personality, and he chopped and changed depending on the environment. He was just Willie. How cool is that? How nice is that? You know, Willie lived that every day. He was authentic every day, and he lived up to that every single day of his life. And he will be greatly missed. Take it from us.
You're listening to Take It From Us. My story, your story, our story.
Take It From Us. Well, Corey Tahuia is an enthusiast. He has a lot of energy. He's a rugby coach. He loves music. He's a proud Cantabrian, and he's a quiz goer. But Corey also lives with obsessive compulsive disorder. or as we might know it as OCD. Now, Corey has a story to tell. He wanted to come on to our program to tell us about his story and to share some information that a lot of people in his life may not be privy to. But the time is right for him to tell us his story. Corey, thank you so much for joining us on Take It From Us. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Ken, how are you?
Oh, I'm going really well. Mental Health Awareness Week, of course, was last week, and you featured prominently on the Mental Health Foundation's website to talk about your journey and your life with OCD, and we'll get to that shortly, but how did you get roped in to becoming a face for Mental Health Awareness Week?
I'm not sure if I'm the face, to be honest. There's a few very good stories on that Mental Health Awareness Week. I am definitely one of them. I'm an intentional peer support trainer, so I was training one of the Mental Health Foundation staff members at the beginning of the year, and she got in contact with me about 2 months ago and said, "Look, really enjoyed the training. You seemed open about talking about your journey, and would you be interested in doing the Mental Health Awareness Week?" And I've been thinking about talking publicly about my story for a while, and I do it as part of my work, so I always talk about my journey. So I said, why not? Let's give it a go. So it was a big decision to make, but it's about time that there's people in my life that don't know anything about my journey. It was going to be a shock to them, but I was aware of that. So I was always worried that people might react in a negative way towards it, but so far, so good.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what's the reaction been from those people that know you that didn't know this about you?
Yeah, shock. I'm surprised that I hid it so well for so long. I've experienced what they call OCD since the age of 12. So I'm 50. I got diagnosed when I was 38. So from 12 to 38, I didn't talk about it, tell anyone, and I hid it for that long. And even from 38 to now, to 50, I don't talk about my OCD. No one knows I've got OCD until now. No one knew apart from family, no one knew about my OCD. People go, "Well, we just didn't know that about you. How did you hide it so well?" And that's what we do. I think a lot of people on mental health journeys, they hide it from their loved ones and from their friends and family. It's just what you do because of the shame that's associated with it.
And what was it about this week that enabled you to feel like it was the time is right to be telling people?
That's a good question. I don't know. I just thought I've been thinking about going public for a long time. Whether I just did it on my own Facebook page or whatever. When I completed my therapy a few years ago, I was going to announce to the world that, I've just completed my therapy for OCD and just put it on my Facebook page. So it's been something I've been thinking about a long, long time. I just didn't know what kind of avenue I could do it with, and the Mental Health Foundation presented the avenue to me. Here's a chance. Yeah, I don't have to do anything, but they interview me and they put it out there. And I just, that's all I had to do. So it was fantastic. I didn't do anything else. So.
We often hear from people who have conditions and syndromes and whatever it might be that they have been dealing with in their lives. And the moment they get a diagnosis, it clicks into place and can be of a great relief. Was that what you experienced 12 years ago?
Yeah, it was. I don't live by my diagnosis or labels. When I actually got my diagnosis, it gave me something to identify. And I thought, that's what I've been doing all this time. Yeah, I've got a name for it. It was a relief to get that diagnosis. I like probably a lot of people who think this OCD is about cleaning, and that's what I thought. I thought, no, it's not me. I'm not obsessive cleaner. But you know, as I learned about OCD, there's 5 or 6 different types of OCD that affect people, and the cleaning is one of them. But I have another type of OCD, so, and I just think, oh, okay, so this is still OCD, and this is what I do, and I fit into this category. So it was actually quite good to learn that, because I just say, oh, I'm not the greatest cleaner out there. I shouldn't announce that on public radio, but yeah, I see all these documentaries that you see on TV are about obsessive cleaning, or hoarding and things like that. And it's not where I fit in. So actually, when they told me I had OCD, that's my first thought. I don't fit into those categories. Mm. Oh, there are other types of categories. So it was good to learn that. And I did fit into another category. So that was interesting to find out.
What about your OCD category would you like to tell us about today?
So I'm a checker. I think that's what, like, there's different names for it, but I think we all get times when we go, did I lock the door? I'll double check it and I'll lock the door. Or did I turn, the great one is about power, did I turn the heater off? That's a classic. So I think everyone it has a moment where they've, I better double check if I turn the heater off. So with me, it would be, did I turn the heater off? Yes, I turned the heater off. That's great. But then my thoughts would turn to something like, you sure you turned the heater off? You better check again, because if you didn't turn the heater off, maybe a fire might start. So it gets that really ugly thoughts in your head that something disastrous might happen. So I'll go and double check again, I've turned the heater off. And even though I've turned the heater off, I go back to double check again, and the thoughts just keep on playing with your mind. Your mind just keeps on playing with you, saying, you sure you checked that? And it gets into that checking type of routine. So I think that's where I was. Mm. That's certainly where I was. And a lot of people can associate with just making sure you double check for something's turned off. That's when it's repetitive and it turns into that obsessive compulsiveness. That's what's happening.
Yeah.
Well, for me, that's when it was
okay. And in those situations, Corey, do you remember turning the heater off so you know that it's turned off?
Oh, I mean, when I was younger, I would listen to it completely and doubt myself. But even though if I know I've turned the heater off, I know I've turned it off. But and so you get frustrated because you're still going back to check. So that's where the frustration gets in because you know you've turned it off. You know you've taken the plug out of the wall. But your mind's still telling you to go and double check. So you get frustrated for yourself or listening to your mind. Sounds weird, but you get frustrated with yourself listening to your mind telling you to go and turn the heater off, all the thoughts that are coming through your mind.
Yeah.
And it's a strange one. And I think that I think by the time I was 15 or 16, so my OCD started when I was 12, and by the time I was 15 or 16, I knew it wasn't what I should be doing, and I shouldn't be following those commands of my thoughts to do stuff. But I couldn't fight it. I was trying to fight it, and it was really hard to fight it. And you just get sucked into this. It's like walking against a headwind, trying to fight it. You're walking against a headwind, and your body's, physically it's hard, and the wind's blowing your face, and mentally it's taking. That's what it's like for me to ignore my compulsions at the time. It was like walking through a headwind. I was so drained and tired that I couldn't ignore those compulsions, and I kept on doing them. That's very interesting. It's very interesting. You learn a lot about yourself. So
yeah, I can imagine. What do you think it's cost you over the years?
Oh, geez, good question. I don't know. I mean, I've managed to achieve a lot as well. So, I mean, I got a good education. I went out and fought for a good education. I've had some good jobs. But, I mean, the toll on my body, mentally and physically, I mean, I was doing up to eight hours a day of OCD checking. And most of that was done at night because you can't really do it during the day when there's other people around. So I had to hide it from people. So most of it was at night. So I wasn't getting a lot of sleep. And it took a physical and mental toll on me when I was in my late 30s. One morning I went to get up to go to work, and I got to the top of my stairs at my old flat, and I couldn't move my legs to go downstairs. So I just sat at the top of the stairs, and I was suffering depression at the same time. So I just sat at the top of the stairs and rang my old boss and said, I can't move down my stairs. And she went, oh, are you hurt? And I went, no, I just can't move my legs. And she was really good. She just said, Corey, do me a favour. Go to bed, get some sleep, and then ring your doctor for me. And let me know what's happening from there. And that's when it all started. So, yeah, I had to leave that job. So it cost me that job. And then, I mean, I've been in and out of part-time employment for the last 10 years. So it probably took me 5 years to build after going through my treatment, my therapy, all that kind of took 5 years to get my confidence to go back into the workforce, in which I managed to get a really good part-time role with a peer support line here in Christchurch. So that was about 2000. So it probably cost me 5 years of work. Well, it's a good question you asked, actually. I have to think about that. Yeah, so I was out of work for 5 years, and then I've been in part-time work until August this year for the last 5 years. So at least I got back into the workforce, and I was comfortable working part-time. But unfortunately, that current role stopped in August, so I'm actually unemployed. I'm looking for a job, everyone, sorry.
What tools do you now have?
I think the best thing for me is to understand that OCD is an anxiety disorder, and when my anxiety is up, likelihood that my OCD will increase. So the first thing I've realised is I always have OCD with me. But if I can memorialise the effects, the OCD I have during my life, during my day, that's great. So one of the tools we use at the Society's unit was intention training. So, I mean, intention training is like building and strengthening your mind and the brain's a muscle, it needs to go to the gym sometimes. So it's about focusing. Attention training is having a lot of different sounds going at once. And then there'll be a command to say, listen to the bells, or listen to the trains, or listen to the bus. It's just being able to, when there's so much stuff going on, it's about focusing on different things. And within that noise background, and focusing on different noises at the time. And that helps strengthen your mind. And when you're doing things like a detached mindfulness, which is another thing that's useful, you can helps you really focus on that mindfulness. So those are the two things I took from the training. And just being aware that it's just a thought. It's just a thought in your mind. By the time I'd finished my therapy, I looked at my OCD as a cheeky child trying to get me to do things or trick me. I'm not listening to you today, mate. You can be cheeky as much as you want in my mind, but I'm not going to listen to you because I know that everything's okay and I don't have to check something and the world's not going to end.
That voice in your head, have you put a name on him or her?
No, I didn't. It took me a long time to get them down to, that voice was a number of things. It was something evil trying to trick me. I mean, over the years, I've had different interpretations of the voice. But the more I gave it something, more I gave it something powerful, and more powerful it was on me. So when I'm taking it down to just a cheeky child trying to trick me, I don't have that association. It's not that powerful anymore. But if I gave it any power, it would really affect me more. My OCD would increase. So a cheeky child, I go, look, mate, it's all good. I know you're just trying to have a bit of fun with me, and I'm not going to listen to you today. It's all good, swears. And it will go, okay. And it will, and then the voice is just my own mind. It's my own thoughts. So I was like, sweet. And it will just shut off. So it's great. If I gave it any more attention than it actually is needed, then it would probably be more powerful.
Corey, tell us about IPS, International Peer Support, and your involvement there.
Yeah, Intentional Peer Support.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Intentional Peer Support.
Yeah, so Intentional Peer Support started in the United States the 60s and 70s. It was founded by Sherry Mead. So that's something I came to, and that's really a big part of my own recovery, my own journey, was in terms of dealing with my OCD and my depression and stuff. So I got trained as an intentional peer supporter in 2016, and I went on the, I volunteered for a line called Warm Line, which is a peer support line. And there's a lot of things about intentional peer support. We don't see people as fragile. We see people as strong, and especially if you've been on a mental health journey, we see you as a survivor and strong. And I think a lot of systems are set up to do good, but they kind of keep people as fragile. And I think if we can see people as strong, even if they don't believe it, if we can reinforce the fact that we see them as strong, that's a big part of them to go on their journey, to help them on their journey. We don't live by our labels, so we don't live by our diagnosis. Some people get their diagnosis and it can shut them down. It can really shut them down. Or it can really have a lot of effects on them. For me, intentional peer support, my diagnosis is just part of who I am.
Right.
It's part of my journey. I'm still the same person I was before I got my diagnosis. Love my rugby, I coach rugby, I love my cuisine, etc., etc. I do all those things still, before and after my diagnosis, so I don't need my diagnosis of OCD. Where some people let their diagnosis take control of their life. And I guess the thing about intentional peer support is it's about walking with someone instead of doing for someone. So we're walking with people on their own journey today. We're not going to dive in and help them. We're walking with someone so they find out the way to their own path to support themselves. So yeah, a lot of systems set up to do for we're walking with, which I think is the difference. So intentional peer support has really helped me. I've become a trainer now, which I've been a trainer for the last couple of years in intentional peer support. So that helps too, passing on what I've learnt in my own journey with a framework, training others as other volunteers for our warm line, which is operating. That's really helped as well.
Yeah, and what has the mentoring meant to you, Corey?
The mentoring was great. I mean, all credit to Warm Line, and the mentoring was my first job since my breakdown, since OCD came around, I was diagnosed. So it gave me confidence I could work when your mental health has affected your CV for 5 years, it doesn't look good when you're trying to apply for jobs and you're trying to explain your absence of 5 years. When you're on your journey of, recovery, it's quite scary.
Yeah.
Because you've got to explain to people what happened for the last 5 years. So when I applied for the Warm Minds mentor job, it gave me confidence that I could actually work again. It gave me confidence that an employer trusts me. And it started, it was such a confidence boost to have that role. And then to become a trainer in IPS was another confidence boost and another employer does see confidence in me that I can do things. So I think it's just a gradual confidence boost to get more and more as the work came on. Especially after, when I was at university, I was all about high-powered paid jobs, trying to get high-powered paid jobs, have a security, a career, looking to be financially set up. And then at 38, I'm unemployed, on the dole, and it got nothing. And got to start rebuilding myself from my mental, as part of my mental health journey. So it was a bit shock. It's a bit shock to end up employed, earning good money, and then you're paying off bills with, unfortunately, your benefit money. You're paying off working bills with benefit money. It's not easy.
Yeah. Look, I can imagine how tough that's been for you, but you've shown a lot of courage, Corey.
Thank you.
So, and
for this opportunity,
we thank you. Thanks for everything that you've been doing, and for being brave and courageous, like I say, these last few years to tell people and to go through that uncertainty of their reaction and to be brave enough to do it. So, and thanks for telling us, our listeners, your important story, because it's a really good learning and teaching for all of us.
Well, it's good to have programs such as yours to be able to get people's mental health journeys out there. I mean, the shame is not as big as it was when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, but the shame is around the mental health is still there, and I think the shame is the one thing that stops people sharing. They feel that they're different, or they're broken, or they're wrong, or they're not right. And none of that is true. In fact, if you're on a mental health journey, you're actually really strong and a survivor. And share it with someone. Share that journey no matter what it is. Share whatever you're feeling, your thoughts with someone, and get the support you need. Because if you don't, if I could talk to someone when I was 15 or 16 or 17, I would have.
Right.
And I think it would have saved a lot of stuff in my life. But I didn't feel that, it was a hard time and there was a lot of shame around. So no matter what you're feeling, if it's OCD or whatever you feel is going on for you, if it's depression, please talk to someone about it and share it, because it's going to be, I think, a good step. Mm. And it might be some challenges on your path, but it's going to be better in holding it in for yourself, because that's when it doesn't go well.
Yeah. I'm a similar age to you, Corey, and I firmly believe that my best years are still ahead of me. You're not old, man. Your best years are ahead of you.
I feel old. I'm turned 50 this year, so I feel old. So
middle-aged.
I like that.
Yeah. No, we're not old men, Corey. We're middle-aged. Well, there's a lot to look forward to.
I've been on Radio Sport over the past year. So,
great.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm a big sports fan, so, I think it's good that you're doing stuff like this. Well, I think it's fantastic that you're spending your time to practice
such a
cycling.
That's
fantastic.
Look, getting people on our program is one of the great highlights for me each week, Corey. It's been great having you on, and please look after yourself and take care.
Will do. Thank you, mate. Thank you. See ya. Ka kite. Take all you can bear. Just call me up, because
that one's an oldie but a goodie. Phil Collins, True Colours, here on Take It From Us. Well, Sione Hopewate has faced many challenges in his life, from a traumatic childhood to battling addiction to now raising a family. And Sione now helps others by sharing his personal journey and spreading a message of hope. Sione, it's so lovely of you to join us on Take It From Us. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me on your show today.
We wanted to have a chat about your life and where you've come from and where you're at now. How are you going now?
I'm doing really good now. I'm in a really good space in my life, and I feel like I've achieved so much compared to how I've been in the past. I come from a really religious background, but at the same time, I had a little bit of a traumatic upbringing, and my trauma has got to do around my my attachment. Like when I was born, I was adopted out of my family. And at the age of 8, my adoptive father had remarried and had kind of left me behind with my biological family, you know. And at the age of 8, I was too young to fully understand how much of an impact that was going to have on me. But it did, you know, and I wasn't aware of this until my older age. And that kind of led on to addictions, where I think I was form 2. And when I was form 2, that was the first time I ever tried cannabis. And then, you know, moving on from there into like, you know, going into high school, I had a taste of cannabis here and there as I kind of grew and developed. It wasn't until I was like 16, 17 that I really picked up the taste or the addiction to cannabis. And I was addicted to cannabis until I was about 18 years old. And I went to, it was called Auckland Institute of Technology at the time, where I really, really picked up for me. And I was using cannabis at the same time I was experimenting and, you know, kind of in the drinking environment as a tertiary student. But cannabis was really my main hook. And I remember going overseas, and when I went overseas, I went away for about 3 years. And during that whole time, I never used any drugs. I never really drank or anything. But I had come back from Australia, met my wife, and then me and my wife were married. But even though when I was married to my wife, I was still kind of, you know, from my friends and my upbringing, still handing me cannabis, and I just used to bring it home and just chuck it in the drawer. And whoever visited me and they still used cannabis, it was their lucky day. It's like, hey, man, I've got all this weed on me. Take this with me. And I just remember one day my wife was like, let's have a smoke. I was like, nah, I don't want to have a smoke. And she has Let's just try it. Let's experiment. And I remember telling her, like, I'm telling you now, if we have a smoke, you're going to regret it, you know? So then we had a smoke together. And then it started off from there, you know? It just started from Friday nights. And then Monday to Friday, I work. And Friday night, we'll come again, have another smoke. And it started from Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. And it went for a full weekend, and eventually gradually progressed to, I'll smoke on Friday night, I'll smoke on Saturday night, I'll smoke on Sunday night, I'll smoke on Tuesday night, then I'll smoke on Thursday night. It got to a point where I was just smoking every day, you know? And it was like that for a good 18 years. And I kind of, you know, I kind of got away with it because I was probably the functioning stoner. Like, I would smoke, and I would come inside, I would clean the house, do the washing, do the dishes, everything, vacuum. And when that's all done, I would make dinner. And it wasn't until I had children that my wife started to have a problem. Mm-hmm. You know? But all of that was just an escape for me. Just to get away from the trauma, you know, just get away from the not feeling too good, not feeling good enough about myself. and got to a stage where I really hit rock bottom. You know, I just hated my job. My relationship was turning into crap. You know, I started experimenting with other drugs also, a little bit of meth, a little bit of ecstasy, trips, and some acid. And yeah, I was at the breaking point. I just was at a stage of losing my relationship with my wife, you know, break down the relationship. And I really needed to do some real work on myself. And I started doing, you know, I started seeking help. You know, I started ending up doing programs on wellness for men, did mindfulness. I did a wellness recovery action plan, or the REC program, where I started to be a mentor there. And I realized, like, man, you know, the relationship I had with myself was really bad. And that kind of reflected on the relationship I was having with others, you know? And I kind of felt like, man, if I can improve the relationship I have with myself, or how it is that I feel about myself, that will probably help with improving the relationship I have with my wife, the relationship I have with my siblings and other family members, my workmates, and just extending out to relationships and the society at large, you know, whoever I interact with. But I felt like in all the stuff that I was doing and all the work that I did on myself and just the interactions I was having with other people, it was more common than you thought it was, you know? It was more common than I thought it was, you know? And I think it's really important that, you know, people become transparent on what their issues are and what their problems are, because other people are going through the same thing. You know, especially for myself being a male, you know, a man, society has this image of us being strong or tough, you know? And sometimes if we get emotional, we have a little cry or tongue, there's a stigma of, oh, something wrong with that guy needs to toughen up, you know? But really, we're all humans, you know? We have these emotions. And I feel that men need to be able to have the ability to express these emotions that they're going through, you know, or that they're having. Hiding them inside, or my personal experience, just hiding all my emotions inside and all my hurt and pain, regardless of how hard you try, eventually those emotions and those feelings that you have will manifest itself in other ways. Yeah?
Yeah.
And hiding, it's not going to help you.
So how about the trauma that you went through as a young man, and or as a boy, really? How does that sit with you now?
It's just, when I reflect on it and I look at it, I understand how I was feeling at the time. Like, you know, my adoptive father had, I feel like, abandoned me. And I remember standing at the window at night looking out the street, you know, down the road, and having a cry, thinking like, are you going to come back and get me? Are you going to come back for me? And then I realized, you know, all that time, because he never came down that road and I was expecting him to come back for me, that made me not feel good enough about myself, you know? That doesn't make me feel good about myself. And those were the underlying thoughts and feelings that I was having at the time, and that I didn't realize my whole life growing up kind of what's behind all these stupid decisions I was making, you know, all these other character actions and decisions that I was making that wasn't doing me any favors, really. But, yeah, when I look at it and I reflect on it, I just feel like, wow, if I had been taught in primary school about 14 feelings and thoughts and how that kind of affects me, then maybe I would have had a different pathway in life, you know? Maybe I would have made better decisions about use of drugs and use of cannabis. But yeah, that childhood trauma has a tremendous effect on me, you know? And there's other people out there that kind of, in similar situations where they've been whanged out, or there's been a breakdown in relationship between mom and dad, or a breakdown in the whole family in general. You know, children kind of take a responsibility of what's happening around them. We're really, they're not aware of how much of an effect that these things happening around them are going to have on them in the long run. Yeah. Not only that, with how things have been in my past life to now, I've just graduated from Auckland University of Technology with a Bachelor of Health Science and Counseling. Yeah.
Way to go, man.
Yeah. And my wife is actually training also. She'll finish at the end of the year, but I've just finished in the last semester. And I have a big desire now for helping men, especially young boys, you know, even young children, young boys, learn about their feelings, you know, learn about their emotions and trying to encourage them to talk about these things, because these things are the crucial parts of their wellness. Yeah, because we've been taught in a way to harden up, straighten your shoulders and straighten your back, you know? Where really, we should be taught differently, where when things happen to us, it's okay to have a cry, you know? It's okay to feel sad about things. It's natural to be affected by these things that are really important to you, you know? And like I said before, in society, we kind of taught to be men, harden up, and don't worry about your feelings. We need to address our feelings.
And what are your hopes for the future?
That is my biggest hope. You know, my biggest hope is that men are okay with the way they feel and their emotions, and they're able to express it, knowing that that's a real sign of strength, you know? It's a real sign of strength to be transparent of losing something really important to you, or grieving over something that's taking an effect on how you feel, you know? And I think in the future, for my son, you know, I've got two boys, you know? For my son, or my two sons, I want them to know that having a cry is okay, you know? It's more of a sign of masculinity than it is of femininity, you know? And that there's some real strength in it about being transparent about how you're feeling and everything like that. Yeah.
Man, look how far you've come. Right?
Yeah. And I've done amazing things, you know? I'm also consumer consultant. I'm part of the Jura Pacifica committee, where it's a group of people with lived experience that kind of come and challenge some of these policies and some of the ways things are held for people seeking help with addictions and mental health. And we can have a voice in there where we can say, oh, well, these things don't work, or these things are the things that we found useful in these programs and these policies they have put up. So, yeah, I just found that working on myself has actually opened up all these other opportunities, you know, even this opportunity I had to be on the Talk Host Radio with you. Yeah, so
great.
Yeah.
Well, look,
it's done so many things for me.
Fantastic. Look, thanks, Sione. Thanks for everything that you're doing. And I know that you're sharing your story and encouraging others to share theirs, but also for telling us today about the trauma and where you've come from. And there is hope for everybody. If we can confront our feelings and talk about them, there is hope for everyone. And I think that message is really clear and so welcome. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Kate. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Is Bruno Mars, Just the Way You Are, here on Take It From Us. Time to wrap things up, as we always do, though, every week. It's our Sheldon shout-out. Karen, we're spreading some dap again today. Who are we talking about?
Well, I read an article about a lady named Kelly Francis, otherwise working for an organisation called Whenua Warrior. And I thought, just great work that this organisation's doing. It's a trust working to address hunger and educate people about growing food. And they're doing it in a very practical way. They've installed 1,200 gardens in the backyards of New Zealand homes. So they're teaching people how to grow their own food and installing it for them. So giving people that first sort of step up to being a bit more self-sufficient with their own food. And not only are they helping people save money, but they're teaching people about horticulture and growing your own food. And in that way, they'll be teaching their kids. So hopefully it's just an ongoing education process. And out of it, we're all going to be eating a little bit healthier food. So I just think it's a great organisation to be involved with, and I'm going to see if we can get Kelly to come on the show.
That would be fantastic. Yeah, I'd love to talk to Kelly about what she's doing and her cause. And you're so right about growing healthier food, and now's the time to be planting as well, isn't it? Hey, we're into spring, time to get in those summer crops. I made a mention of that to my partner just the other day. Actually, we've got a little veggie garden, Karen. You know, we're probably not the world's greatest gardeners, but we've got a green thumb in there somewhere, and it's a bit of fun, and the kids love it. That's the main thing.
Excellent.
Get them involved. It's exciting. Yeah, I think that'll be great to get her on. Hopefully she can join us in a later edition of Take It From Us. We're right in the guts of the school holidays as well. I just wish everybody all the best for these holidays. It wasn't... When were the last ones? July. 11 or 12 weeks ago. Man, that third term has absolutely flown by. We're not going away this time, so we are like a lot of parents that I know at this time, juggling, just making sure that the kids are well looked after. So in our case, my son will still go to daycare. He's okay. He's looked after. But my daughter is going to have a day with her friend one day a week, and then it's our turn to look after her the following week. There's some time at school in their fun club program for a couple of days, and then she'll just be hanging out with me, which is easier said than done when I've got other things to do and work to do. And she says, Daddy, when are you finished? Please, Dad, when are you finished? And I'm saying, look, darling, can you please just be patient for half an hour? I'll do my best. I'll be with you. We'll play Cluedo. She's right into board games at the moment. So we'll manage. We'll get through it. But I know, because this is a hot topic of conversation with my circle of friends, for those of us with young kids, is the stress and the worry and the pressure that we feel to multitask between working and wanting to be a really good parent. And also, not only that, but actually enjoy the time with our kids when they are at home. It's the school holidays. These are supposed to be exciting times. We're supposed to have fun with the holidays. They shouldn't be a chore. But I know, and I've had these thoughts myself, oh, my God, what are we going to do? This is too much. And I know some people are really kind of self-aware and conscious about how they'll cope, at least for the next couple of weeks. So, look, if you've got any tips on how to get through the school holidays, what works for you, we are all ears here at Take It From Us. We would greatly appreciate any tips that you've got for us. Get to our Facebook page. Leave us a note, of course. That'll be the way to do it. Thanks very much to Karen Murphy, who has produced our program for today. Much appreciated. Thanks to Corey and Sione for sharing their stories with us today as well. Please take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. Look after your kids. Try and make the best of the school holidays. We'll talk again next week on Take It From Us.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page, Take It From Us.